Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview is with Tamara DeWitt. We talk about her new film, Finding Sally. You'll be able to see that on CBC Docs. It's on the documentary channel. And I trust that it's going to get international distribution in the not-so-distant future. And this is a film that Tamara wants to get into the hands of all the right people. And isn't that the goal of most documentarians and filmmakers and storytellers of any kind, really? This is a film about family. It's a film about trust and broken trust. It's a political film. It's a mystery in a way. It's a bit of a, I was going to say it's a detective novel. It's not a detective novel. It's a detective sort of like story where Tamara had to go in and do some pretty intimate, significant, and deep research into what was going on in Ethiopia in the late 60s and 70s, what was going on in Canada as well. As you'll find, the two are connected for Tamara's family. And she goes back home and she interviews her aunts to find one of her sort of missing aunts that she didn't hear too much about from her past and her own story. And so we talk about the politics of the time. We talk about pushing back and about social and political and democratic change. And we talk about why these things matter. We talk about why family stories matter. We talk about memories and how we've been sort of conditioned to think in a particular way and to not necessarily go back and peel back those layers to find out what came before us and find those, you know, see those dots and how they actually connect. And so this is a difficult time in history for the world, but for Ethiopia in particular during this period. And so stick with us. And I think you're going to enjoy the conversation, but I think you're going to enjoy the film even more. So Finding Sally, CBC Docs, check it out. And stay tuned for the interview with Tamara coming right up. And don't forget, davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and my speaking. You can buy a copy of Real Change is Incremental there, and certainly would echo some of the messages that are coming through in the film today in our conversation that Tamara and I have. And don't forget too, face-to-facelive.ca. By the time you hear this, I think there could well be over 500 interviews on the site, and we're pretty excited about that. And you can advertise with us. You can sign up for our email newsletter. You can support us through Patreon. We would appreciate any or all of the above. And if you can't do any of those things, please consider leaving a review for us on iTunes, and spread the word digitally. Send the interview to your friends and your family. Share it on social, share it on Facebook, and sign up for the newsletter and help us get word on the street about Face to Face. We're pretty excited about what we're doing here, and we're hoping to continue it for quite a long time. So stay tuned and yeah, coming right up. And don't forget, rabble.ca, another platform where I exist for a whole host of other writers and thinkers and bloggers and journalists writing about news for the rest of us. Stay tuned. Coming right up, Tamara DeWitt talking about her new film, Finding Sally. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here today with us in a completely different time zone in another part of the world. We have Tamara DeWitt here with us to talk about her new film, Finding Sally. Tamara, thank you so much for your time today and for joining us here on Face to Face.
No, thank you for making time to talk to me.
So we've got a few kilometers between us. We've got a COVID crisis that's providing some context for this conversation as well, and we've got a film that's full of meaning for you, I would think, personally, and from you have a very big family, by the way, and also there's this political import, it seems to me, to the film as well. I'd love for you to just sort of provide a little bit of context, you know, before we step into chatting more about the film. And by the way, congratulations on the film.
Thank you. Well, I guess, in terms of a bit of the context, maybe even about me, I'm an Ethiopian Canadian. I grew up in Ottawa. I lived in Toronto for 15 years. And then now I've really been sort of living out of my suitcase, I guess, between Canada and Ethiopia. And one of the real driving forces for me to start spending more time in Ethiopia was to work on this film. And this film really follows the story of my family, because I found out that I had an aunt that no one had ever told me about. And in finding out about this aunt, Sally, it was really the catalyst for the whole film. And for me to look at both contemporary Ethiopian history and going back a little bit into the 1970s, into the time in Ethiopia of the overthrow of Emperor Haile Selassie, and a period when Sally disappears. So this film is my investigation into what happened to Sally and really why my family wasn't talking about her. And it was an opportunity for me to realize that this isn't really a story that is specific only to my family. It's something that has impacted most families in Ethiopia.
So it's kind of interesting that you say that about most families in Ethiopia. And I think it's part of the world that a lot of folks don't know a great deal about. And thanks for that for me too, just providing some history and context to what was happening at the time. And I've, as my listeners know, I've spent a fair bit of time in Southeast Asia with the work that I do. And so I'm very familiar with Cambodian history, for instance, and the Khmer Rouge. And it was around the same time, the late 60s, Vietnam War, into the 70s, the late 70s, and then, of course, the Ethiopian famine. And so that was really great for me to get that. So, and thanks. But so it's a family film for you, but it seems like it's so much more than that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think my motivations to make this film, when I started trying to research about Sally, I didn't know it was going to be a film. I just knew that I wanted to know more, and I wanted to understand why there was this sort of culture of silence within my family and within other families. But I also thought it was an opportunity for audiences outside of Ethiopia, who, of course, will also watch the film, to try and understand what are the stories, the histories and the background of, Ethiopians in your community, Ethiopians who are your coworkers, who may be your neighbors, because specifically in Canada, I know that Ethiopians are, I think, if not the largest, the second largest Black African population. So there's a lot of us there. And I think, through mainstream Canadian media and culture, we don't really have a good understanding about what has driven Ethiopians to flee and to migrate to countries like Canada. So I hope that this film also, I think, gives a bit of context to that, because really, the only thing we hear about Ethiopia is about famine. And of course, there's much more to the story of the country than just that.
You know, it's interesting that you say that about the second largest population in Canada. And it's just what I love about documentary film, and I say this almost every time I interview someone, is the layers to the stories. And it's just a reminder to me how all of us have, you know, complicated, paradoxical pasts. Some of them are more difficult than others. But we all have stories, you know, to tell and things to learn from and memories and so on. And I love that, I'm going to use the word commiserative, but that aspect of it that sort of builds this global community. We really are all connected in one way or another. And for me, your film has all of a sudden, in just a matter of minutes, become a film about new Canadians. And for a Canadian like myself, who's lived here all my life, to say, hang on a minute here. These folks are coming with sometimes crazy, difficult, emotional, violent stories. They're leaving families to come here to build new lives. And did you have that sense going into this film as well? Was that something that you were hoping to accomplish, or was that more of something, sort of something you came to after the fact?
I mean, I think that growing up, I never really understood or really questioned why, you know, my father's family, which is Ethiopian, why they were living in Canada, because I always grew up hearing these sort of exciting and fun stories about, you know, life in Ethiopia. Because my grandfather was a diplomat, they lived in Ghana, Nigeria, and Sudan, and then ultimately came to Canada when the first Trudeau wanted to establish, you know, stronger diplomatic ties for Ethiopia, and that meant opening an embassy in Canada. And that's why my family came to Canada. But sort of lost in all those stories was the idea of why did they stay? And I think it really wasn't until I was doing this film and having conversations with my aunts and with my grandmothers that I actually realized and understood that my grandparents really raised my father and his sisters with this idea that you may be growing up outside of Ethiopia because of my job, because I'm a diplomat, or you may be outside of Ethiopia because you're pursuing, you know, university, or you're getting, you know, some sort of other training, but the impetus is that afterward you learn and you go back and you develop and you better your country. But because of the revolution, that didn't happen. Mm. And that was sort of the, you know, the piece that I found very interesting that no one ever really dug into in terms of the family history. They just talked about we grew up here and we went there and then we moved to Canada and then suddenly we're in present day. And it was kind of like this part of the collective memory of my family that was just glossed over. And of course, now it's very apparent to me that for the most part, they didn't go back because it wouldn't have been safe to do that.
You talk about collective memory. It's really interesting. There's a line near early in the film about being safer to, and I think it might have been you narrating, I'm not sure at this point, but safer to forget than to remember. And Can you talk a little bit about that? And I felt like I sensed a little bit from some of your aunts that maybe they weren't totally crazy about this film you were making. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I wondered about some. And then is it Menby that is the keeper of the family stories, which is wonderful, by the way. If you know, the fact that your family has somebody like that, I think is just brilliant. And a reminder for all of us that we need to be keeping our stories somewhere, whether it's, you know, a diary or a photo or a film or an oral tradition, whatever the heck it is. But yeah, can you talk a little bit about that memory and the pain and the trauma and is it safer just to forget about it and walk away?
I mean, I think for myself, I mean, I'm very blunt and that's, right. I think, much more my Canadian side and you know, my Canadian upbringing. I don't think that's
blunt and maybe a little sarcastic too. Is there a little sarcasm in there as well?
Maybe sometimes. but I think I'm more direct and I tell people, like, this is how I feel, and this is what I think. And I found, you know, from living in Ethiopia that, you know, even though my aunts lived abroad for many years, there's still this underlying culture of maybe not expressing your emotions that much and sort of saying what may be the thing that's accepted to say. So I think for me, when I look at my film and I think back at, you know, the interviews that my aunts and my grandmother gave, I do feel like they're remembering Sally through a lens that they're comfortable with. So they're each giving you their own version of their sister. And I think, you know, to the other question you raised about their level of comfort or interest in taking part, I think it was also really because when I found out about Sally, some of the first conversations I had were with my grandmother. And I think that gave my grandmother the chance to sort of reflect and realize that by not talking about Sally and the fact that I was 30 when I found out about her, that that's a huge piece of the family memory that's been lost. That Sally, you know, had a certain agenda and motivation to make Ethiopia a better country. And that is something that the younger generations like me should not miss out on understanding. So it was really my grandmother that said, we need to do this. The generations to come in our family need to know about Sally. Other, you know, young people in Ethiopia need to know about what happened in the 1970s and why that happened, so that they can learn about that and learn from that to create a better society. So it was really, you know, my grandmother saying, we're going to do this, and then the sort of willing and unwilling command performance of the rest of the family to sort of fall in line. But I think, you know, even though it was difficult to talk about her, you know, some of my aunts certainly are not really that comfortable with being filmed. It was also, I think, if you went back and asked them now, something that was also therapeutic, because it gave them the opportunity to think about their sister and to process that. And I feel hopefully to come out of it, I guess, with a better way to think about her and to remember her.
Yeah, it really is interesting, and it's certainly something I've interviewed other filmmakers about over the last 5 or 6 years, documentarians particularly. But this idea of collective memory and this whole idea of remembering, so that you sort of can remember to forget, in a sense, so that you can not just celebrate, but manage and work through, you know, that trauma. And I certainly come from a family that didn't really do that, and a lot of, you know, history that was sort of swept under the carpet, if you know what I mean. And I think a lot of us are from that kind of a worldview or a context, I guess, you know, where it was better. You know, I was interviewing somebody recently, and an investor and a guy who works with international NGOs and offering up advice to people during this COVID crisis. What do you do? How are we going to make it to the next paycheck, et cetera? And he was talking about these cultural taboos about, oh, gee, you know, you don't talk about finances. Well, if you don't talk about finances, you sure don't talk about your sister's, you know, revolutionary past. Right. And yet I feel like you've sort of taken on this personal story and said to the world, hey, we should all kind of be doing this. This is, to me, this, for me, finding Sally's a bit of a shout out to, and a challenge to others to say, hey, maybe it's time to peel back a few layers in your own life.
Yeah, certainly. And I mean, that's a big part of my interest and motivation with making this film specifically, you know, for Ethiopians in Ethiopia, and also Eritreans and those who are living, you know, in the diaspora, because I feel like we tend to sort of gloss over history. We don't look at things, and we don't learn from our past. And I mean, one of the things I found really bizarre in starting to research this film, I went to the university here in Ethiopia, and I thought, like, maybe I can find like a PhD student or a master's student who's studying this period. And I spoke to the dean of history, and I said, you know, I'd like to have someone to work with me in my company. And he said, no, we don't study that. And I thought that was, you know, so telling of, like, how does a country look at our past? His response was like, that's not important. We study ancient history. So he, you know, studies, you know, the ancient kingdoms in Ethiopia, you know, before the time of Christ, because that's what's been given value here as a place to learn from, and something that's important to remember. But anything that's happened, I think, in the last, you know, 20, 30 or 50 years haven't been prioritized in the same way. And of course, it's also political. What your political ideology and how you view the country now and then, of course, will change how you look at those things. But I think it's a huge missed opportunity for critical thought and conversation that's really important for Ethiopians to be having.
Is that kind of a top-down thing, or is that bottom-up? Is that sort of cultural, like, would you say most Ethiopians feel the same way? Or is that being kind of imposed ideologically to say, hey, you know what, let's just not talk about this, and let's not study it, and let's not go on talk shows about it, and not write about it in editorials and so on, and kind of, as you say, glossed over? Is it sort of understood that that's the way things are?
I mean, I feel like it's maybe a bit of like a cultural hangover from
right.
the communist period, because the dictatorship that took over after the emperor was overthrown in 1974, these were communists, or these were people who were taking communist ideology so that they could have a closer relationship with Russia. So that meant, you know, if someone in your family died during their period of leadership, it would be, and I'm not talking about someone who's died from natural causes, someone who was seen as politically opposed to the government,
right.
Someone who was in a group like the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Party that Sally was a member of. If someone died in circumstances connected to that, it would not be possible or safe for you to mourn them, because you'd basically be acting against the government. So I think it's small indications like that that told people it's not safe or perhaps wise to remember those things and to talk about them publicly. So I think it's really only been in the last 10 years that this idea of looking at the Derg period and looking at the Red Terror, which was, you know, the period of sustained violence and state-sponsored killing across the country, that's very new. And I think that that started partially because the government supported the opening of a museum that is a memorial to the Red Terror. So even though, you know, that's a great museum, they helped me a lot with the film, but that is a museum looking at that period from a perspective that is politically okay with the current government. So but I think that starting up, then people started releasing books. There's been another film that came out, a dramatic film about a decade ago. So I think people are starting to come out, that I really want with this film to encourage people to talk about this more, and for people to also, you know, dissect this moment and what does it mean for us now.
I love that you make the point of, and I don't remember which aunt or which sister it was, but, you know, the line was, our conversations were always political. And I think it was when your family was living in Ottawa, or at least part of your family was living in Ottawa, and you couldn't help not to be political, I suppose, during that time in some respects, living in the capital of Canada and so on. But is there a sense in which you want people to become, would you say, you know, you kind of wrap up the film talking about the future and change. And I also love the fact that, you know, Sally believed in climbing the tallest mountain. It sounds like, you know, to me that you do too.
Yeah.
And I'm with you on that, by the way. Is that the challenge? Is that the push? Let's not just watch the film. Let's not just think about it and have a coffee, but let's actually peel back the layers and step into this and see what's next.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely for Ethiopian viewers, that is what I want to have happen. I want this film to trigger critical thought and sort of intergenerational conversation. So if you're someone who's 20 or 30 or 40 who wasn't, you know, alive in the 1970s, I want you to watch the film and then go and ask an elder in your family about, you know, what happened to you during that period, and you know, to start to share those stories. But also to start to think about, you know, what is the future that you want for your country?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the sort of systemic change that you're looking for? Because Ethiopia is heading into an election. And I think this is an important opportunity to look at what's happened in the past with the democratic process, or the lack of a democratic process, and think about what can we take from the young people in the 1970s? Because for me, I mean, I can't vote in Ethiopia. I'm a Canadian. But in researching Sally, I found that a lot of the ideology and the hope and the aspirations of her group, to me, really still resonates today.
That's fascinating, because I was going to ask you, I love that notion of resonance. And I was going to say, you know, did you, so a couple questions here, I suppose. Did you come across any sort of pushback, you know, to your research and to the film and as you got in a little deeper? Or, I mean, it's probably a bit of both, but, or did you find people saying, hey, you know, we're with you. This is great. We kind of feel the same way, but we were waiting for somebody to take the lead. Does that make sense?
I mean, I think I spent a really long time, you know, doing research and trying to track down people who were part of this political organization and Sally's comrades. Because, of course, the perspective that my aunts have and my grandmother is very much from the outside looking in. They weren't with Sally when she went underground, so they don't really know what she was doing. So I felt that it was important for me to do, you know, research by talking to her comrades, talking to the other members of the EPRP, to try and understand not only what Sally was doing, but what was their mission, what was their mandate, how were they trying to affect change. And I think that that certainly was a very important process, but also a very slow one, because this is still a political organization that's active today. There's still, you know, there's been splinters within the group, but they're still largely in opposition to the current government in Ethiopia. And of course, I think they were initially suspicious about who was I and what was I trying to do. And of course, when you're in a clandestine organization like that, you don't use your real name. You don't talk about your family members. And even though Sally did some of those things, for the most part, her comrades didn't know that she had a brother. So it was also confusing. Why is this woman contacting me to say she's the relative of Sally, but I didn't know Sally had a brother who she's saying is her father? So I think it was, you know, a snowball effect of once I won over one person, and they were okay with my intentions, then, you know, they would introduce me to someone else. But there's certainly still, you know, other people who never responded to me or never followed up, because I think there was this underlying suspicion. And I'm sure now that once more people start to see the film, I'll be contacted by more people that have, you know, other memories to do with Sally.
So that raises a question about sort of post-film, post-festival run, post-showing in the museum and so on. I'd love to talk about that in a couple of minutes, but can you tell me a little bit about that, that suspicion, you know, clandestine, such a great word, you know, and one of your aunts talks about the notion of scientific socialism. To me, it seems like one sort of communist group pushing back, and maybe this is unfair, but communist group pushing back against a hyper sort of communistic group. And it really became about power and the Red Terror. It sounds horrifying, and the Derg and so on. But the scientific socialism, you know, breaking things down, breaking down the family. There was a phrase, I think, that one of your aunts talked about, which meant to point, you know. I'm gonna find out, you know. And so that to me just, I mean, continues to break down trust and relationships and community. And so who could you go to, right? So I would imagine some of that is still very much, you used the word resonating earlier, and I would think very much still a part of the culture. So yeah, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I think what you're referring to is a clip in the film where one of my aunts sort of talks about how the Derg really asserted their power or their grip on society, and that was using this term of scientific socialism to really break, you know, the connections within households in Ethiopia.
Tamara, the Derg were the not the EPRP. They were the ones pushing back the coup, sort of against Selassie the emperor and so on. Just to give a little more history.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing to also clarify there is maybe that, you know, the emperor was really overthrown because there was a populist movements among, you know, students and workers who were looking for democratic change in the country.
Got it.
But what happened, you know, amidst all of these protests, the army came in and sort of used the opportunity to take control. And of course, it was people quickly realized that the army doesn't necessarily have the best intentions of the people front of mind. And the army is not really a communist based group, or they don't have the full communist ideology that was what was driving the student movement. So the army really, you know, snuck in and took power. And then groups like the EPRP that Sally was a part of stood up and said, you know, this is not what we signed up for. This is not what we agree with. And we want to move towards a democratic government. And then started protesting against that Derg military dictatorship.
Which then led to, well, I mean, it sounds so simple, but very complicated, but led to the Red Terror.
Exactly, exactly. And I guess to come back to your earlier question about the idea of how they broke down the bonds within society, I mean, a really clear example that my aunt gives in the film is the idea of breaking the connection between children and their parents, or young people and their elders, who normally a young person would listen to their elder. But now you're told by the government you don't have to listen to them. You can, you know, do what you want. And then also making it difficult for people to access religion. So making it difficult for people to go to church, and, you know, through even a very simple thing like saying on Sundays you can't drive your car. And Sundays are the day that people would drive to church, because this is a, you know, country where 50% of the population are Orthodox Christians. And on Sunday after church, you would drive to see your family. Suddenly, if you're not allowed to drive, this has become a very sort of simple way to start eating away at those family and community connections. And the Red Terror was really an opportunity where people were encouraged to tell on their neighbors, to report on, you know, someone who you see on your street, someone who you see in your family, who may or may not be doing something that is somehow against the government. And I think there's, as I said earlier, a lot of sort of hangover, you know, from those that period that still, you know, exists today. I find even for something as simple as going to, like, register a business or signing a lease for your house, there just seems to be this extra level of bureaucracy that so many people have to be involved, and so many people have to see what you've done or what you're doing to know that it's true, because there's this underlying notion that people can't be trusted.
Yeah, I've, you know, doing the work that I've done over the years, I've worked in some countries that have a similar edge, that bureaucracy. I mean, there's bureaucracy everywhere, obviously, and I guess we get used to what we live, I suppose. But you, when you travel and you see other worldviews and other perspectives, it really does have an impact on how well, it should have an impact, I suppose, on how you see the world. But that almost that pre-communist era, you know, or post, I should say, communist era, and that latent kind of lack of trust. One of the things I noticed about Cambodia many, many years ago was that it seemed like there was this sense, this inability to trust others. And you have to think, you have to ask those questions. This is why it's so fascinating to me, you know, your comment about schools and academia not looking at this period in a really sustained, intentional way. And the hope is that, you know, ultimately that they will, because isn't that the way to actually come to terms with you know, these issues, this trauma, this past, and actually move into a, you know, a progressive and positive change, if that makes sense.
Certainly. And I think there's a lot of similarities between, you know, what happened in Ethiopia around the time of the revolution and after, and what happened in Cambodia, or even if you look, you know, further back at the Russian Revolution. There's, you know, similar things that are happening and that are repeating.
Hey, listen, we're going to need to wrap up in a few minutes, and that's too bad. And you're going to go into your afternoon and evening there on the other side of the world, and I'm just starting my day here. Tell me about transcendental meditation and how that had an impact on not only your research, but your family and Sally and so on?
Fascinating
part of the story, but fascinating part of the story, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on meditation. I don't think I have the patience for it. But one of my aunts, she's a meditation teacher. She's been teaching meditation since the early 1970s. And I think, you know, if you look at all of my aunts and how they survived, and how they dealt with what happened to the family in the 70s and 80s, I think, you know, her, because she had meditation to fall back on, certainly was an assistance to her. And I think, you know, that's perhaps one of the reasons why maybe she managed to stay in Ethiopia and to live through all the horrible things that were happening around her in the late 1970s, because it really gave her strength or rock, I guess, in the same way that for many people, religion would do the same.
And one of your some fascinating photos in the film too, about the yogi and meeting with the emperor and so on. And one of your aunts is quite an artist, and I love that scene of the paints and the brushes. And once again, I mean, another, that's a form of meditation, right? It seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think probably all of my aunts have their own way, you know, of dealing with these things, right, and the ways that it manifests in their lives and through their personalities.
So the film wraps up with the monument and your work and all this research, and where next for you with this story? Obviously COVID, and it's going to probably change how you distribute the film, and it's going to be airing on April 30th, coming up in the not so distant future on CBC. And what's really important is that it will still be there for people to see post opening night. Can you talk about what's next? How this might have an impact academically? Could the film be used in schools? I mean, are you thinking along those lines?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely thinking about doing those things specifically in Ethiopia to mm-hmm. make sure that there is access to the film beyond the TV broadcast here. And so that means, because the film right now is largely in English, we were in the process before we had this work shut down because of COVID of dubbing the film, so that the film is available in some of the larger languages that are spoken here in Ethiopia, so that it's much more accessible for things like community screenings, for screenings in the cinema, in the Red Terre Memorial Museum, to try and do outreach and discussion around the film in schools. So that's sort of really my plan and my focus for the coming months. And I'm using this time of being locked down at home right now to really work on ironing out some of those details, because I think remembering and looking back at the Red Terror is much more than just one film. I want to encourage and try to document other people's memories, so that there is much more of an archive of content about this period that we have kept as a country and as a society.
I love that notion of documenting memories, and maybe that's a good place to sort of wrap it up for us today. I mean, there's always so much more to talk about tomorrow. I mean, it's just, I love the layers that you peeled back, and it's such a great film, such a complicated and difficult story, and yet you've brought it to life in a way for us to see. And I think, again, great, what a brilliant medium documentary film is to challenge all of us. Yes, it's informative and it's historical, and isn't it interesting to know more about what happened, right? Those are great things, but mm-hmm. but I love that for me anyway that you've challenged me this idea of memory and of our own story. And I think there's so many favorite moments for me, but the notion that every family should have a keeper of the family story is probably one of my favorite takeaways from your film. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate you being with us here on Face to Face, and congratulations again on the film. And I'll be definitely we'll be doing some shout outs about it and making sure people know where they can find the film online. And so what's next for you other than focusing on the film? As has COVID got you? You've got your own production company, don't you, as well? Or you guys must be working on a few things in pre-production. And what's the future looking like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I do production work for other Ethiopian filmmakers. So I have two Ethiopian directors I'm working with now. But luckily, they're writing. So they're writing their scripts, and we're writing funding applications, so that's okay. We do have some films we were co-producing with European companies that are sort of put on hold until it's safe to start shooting there. And then myself, I started working on the research and writing for my next documentary. So it's a bit of a slower time, but it's also, you know, as busy as ever.
Well, that's great. Well, stay safe and be well, and thank you for your film. We've been talking with Tamara DeWitt about her new film, Finding Sally. Thanks for joining us today on Face to Face, Tamara.
Thank you so much.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.